Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber. On this episode of Red Inca, we look at how England changed their white ball DNA. For that, we get on a man who just finished writing a book about it.
Matt Roller, co-author of White Hot, the Inside Story of England Cricket's Double World Champions.
We talk about the COVID third 11 that beat Pakistan, depth charts, scouting, Phil Salt, positivity, franchise league assist, power hitting, and how long it can all last when the current generation ages out. Geez, I'm glad that you went through the full name there. okay, 2021, England had to play three ODIs. Well, no one has to play, but England played three ODIs versus Pakistan when the original team and the second team were both unavailable. One had COVID. I can't remember. The other one was probably in lockdown for something else. And they had to pick a third team. And you've written basically a whole chapter on that point for your book. So why?
Well, because it's a pretty crazy state of affairs. So basically what happened was, as you say, they ended up picking a sort of something between a second and a third team. They had a 16-man ODI squad that had just played a series against Sri Lanka that ended in Bristol. And at some point over the 24 hours after that last game, the bubble got breached. This was 2021, where it was kind of, semi-bubble where people were pretty fast and loose, and everyone had to self-isolate because I think four players ended up getting diagnosed with COVID. So that was 16 players wiped out. You obviously had a few injuries around as well, as everyone does. England decided that rather than abandoning the series and having to pay broadcasters back, they would basically pick a load of players at the last minute, test out their depth, and ended up hammering a full-strength Pakistan side 3-0, which was one of the most, I think, extraordinary results that modern white ball cricket has seen in a bilateral series when you think of the players that England were missing. And when you look at the side that Pakistan picked with, Shaheen Afridi taking the new ball, Harris Ralph was there, Hassan Ali, Shadab Khan, pretty much a full-strength team. Babar was captaining as well. And from Tim and I's point of view, we wrote a book on England's white ball revolution from 2015 to 2022, when they become simultaneous holders of both World Cups. And for us, that really summed up how much things have changed in English cricket, because even in 2015, when things started going well, it was quite hard to, think if England had a load of injuries, if they missed a couple of players, they would probably be quite short here. They relied initially on quite a small core of players. And those guys were the main part of that whole 15 to 19 journey. But what happened after that was that style of play filtered down into county cricket, filtered down into England Lions under 19s teams, all the way down throughout the country, basically. And you got to a point where you had a team that hadn't played together almost at all, coming in under a completely different captain to the one that normally captain England, and Ben Stokes. He sort of rushed back from injury, playing basically exactly the same as an England ODI team would. And we thought that was pretty crazy.
You mentioned, the most surprising, most shocking result. You compared it in the chapter to the Australia A situation. For those who don't remember, Australia used to play tri-series, and they had a tri-series set up for Australia, England, Zimbabwe. They decided that England was pretty terrible, but more so they were worried that Zimbabwe wouldn't be good enough. So they inserted Australia A into that series. And of course, Australia A were the best team in that series. And had they not have got decimated by some random selections at the end, might have beaten the Australian team. And it really was the team that would go on to be, the dominant Australian team in that next generation. That, if you look at what happens from, was that 94? I want to say 90.
I think it was 94-5, yeah.
Yeah. So if you look from there until 2007, but I suppose you could put 2015, Australia was pretty good at white ball cricket for a long period of time. That's the kind of model that England are going for, right? They're not going for one-off team that's very good. They're looking for generational talent. And that's really what this chapter is about. You use the phrase that England have coined, which is multiple eyes, multiple times. Tell me about the eyes and times.
So this is basically a sort of a mantra that underpins England's scouting network. So I'm sure a lot of people listening to this podcast will have watched Moneyball and will have sort of discarded old school scouting as a concept because of the fact it comes across very badly in that. England think there is, you know, clearly some value to old school scouting in terms of watching players and being able to make judgment calls on them. But they think that trusting one old school scout is a bad idea. And if you aggregate the opinions of a lot of people that you trust and learn to trust over a number of years because of the fact that they have, you know, seemingly identified good players and been quite good at identifying talent, then that is much better than just having one view, which seems quite intuitive, but I think that sort of underpins that whole idea. So I think that's sort of mainly introduced by Mo Bobat, who has become a pretty influential figure in English cricket, really, since particularly since Andrew Strauss took over as director of cricket in 2015. He became player ID lead, which was a pretty new role at the time, in 2016, and sort of launched England's scouting network as it is today. In 2017, after the North-South series that was a Strauss idea, which a lot of people said was, and probably was to some extent, a nice paid holiday in Barbados and Dubai, but I think also, you know, clearly kick-started England's scouting network in terms of, you know, it had a lot of the white ball set up, went out to those tournaments, looked at a lot of players that were sort of on the fringes of the setup and tried to work out how they would fit into a depth chart. So working out who England's replacement would be if Joe Root went down on the eve of the World Cup, trying to work out who their finisher might be in their T20 team if something happened to, let's say, Ben Stokes at the time, or maybe even Josh Butler before he moved up to Open, and basically formulating that into a depth chart rather than sort of a list of hunches, quite old school way. A lot of it is probably relatively basic, but I think if you look at sort of particularly in white ball cricket, where England were in 2014, 2015, around then, where a lot of it was treated as largely an afterthought, it's, you know, completely brought them up to speed. And also, I think one of the biggest themes of England's white ball revolution is that, you know, if you think of where England should be in any format of cricket based on resources, population, you know, particularly resources, I suppose, they should be a pretty competitive team for the most part, in that it's a, you know, it's not like they're, if you look at how New Zealand did, for example, from a way smaller country, consistently competing in ICC events, England for a long time, much bigger country, you know, history of playing cricket, invented white ball cricket.
I was going to say, invented Red Bull limited overs cricket.
And invented T20 cricket. then they should be doing a lot better than they were, whereas now they're very much sort of up to speed and in the sort of the category of white ball teams that they should be, I think.
Well, you talk about scouting before, and you're right, it's a bit like errors. You know, cricketers now look at the fielding data and it's basically just the old-fashioned baseball errors, and we know it's not a particularly good metric, but there was nothing before that, right? Like, so it's the same with scouting. We didn't have any scouting beforehand. I would say that the majority of wicketkeepers who've been selected in the history of professional cricket have not been selected by another wicketkeeper who knew anything about the art form at all, right? Like, and England, they had Steve Rhodes, they had Bruce French, and I think they might have had another wicketkeeper out there who was, might have been James Foster, who was literally go out and have a look at the next crop of wicketkeepers, which is kind of what you would always expect cricket to do, but of course, that's not what we did. Talk about the depth chart. So they come into that. They've now got to pick a third 11, right? Essentially, yeah, for this Pakistan game. And they took it almost as a challenge of, and this was with the scouting, but also with the data. They end up with 109 players, right, in front of them. And they basically try and pare that down to, you know, players who are not got COVID, not in another bubble, and people they want to have a look at. That seems like the most, like, no one's ever, as far as I'm aware, no one's ever done that in cricket before, just because you don't usually get thrown into that sort of situation. That's almost like a, you know, an NFL draft room at that point.
Yeah, so there's a sort of late night teams call that England's sort of coaching staff log on to. Some of them are still in isolation at this point. All the guys from the performance sort of from the scouting department, so people like James Taylor, who was head scout at the time, people like Bobat himself are all on there, and they basically, it sounded like, you know, obviously not having listened into the call, but from what everyone says, they sort of basically rattled off names pretty quickly when they looked through each of their positions they have. So England sort of will have within their 50 over depth chart, they will have, you know, a list of names who fit under the category attacking opener. And they're like, right, Phil Salt, yeah, works. I think Milan was in there as well. It's probably not the most, maybe not the most like for like for, say, a Jason Roy, but probably fits a similar sort of role to, say, a Bairstow, in that he can hit gaps pretty well in the power play. They put Zach Crawley in as their quote-unquote classy number three, which was the Joe Root role.
Classy number three.
Then has...
I love the way you said that. I hope if you're listening to this on the podcast, you want to go back and see Roller's face when he said that. And it's not him slagging Crawley, by the way. This is a personal issue that me and Roller have about Crawley that just played out of the podcast. But yeah, okay, so they had the classy number three. Who else did they have?
And then you look through the middle order, obviously. Stokes was available as captain or was sort of rushed back from this hand finger injury that he picked up at the RBL. So he was captain because they felt they needed a senior player. And you had Vince battered in the middle order. And you sort of looked down and they tried to replicate stuff like the batting depth. So people like Lewis Gregory and Craig Overton came in as all-rounders. Who could, in Overton's case, take the new ball.
Did Brighton Cass, was that Brighton Cass?
Yeah, Cass came in and a sort of, I suppose, throughout that post-2019 period, England have been looking at different options as sort of Liam Plunkett replacements, and Cass was one of those. Parkinson at the time came in as the top leg spinner behind Adil Rashid. So he ended up with a side that, even though it was obviously different names on the backs of the shirt, sort of looked in terms of roles quite similar to a first choice England one day team at the time. What played out was that they all had very similar roles and that they all played in a similar style. So the sort of thing that we always thought was the best comparison was Phil Salt coming in as the sort of Jason Roy clone. Mm. And even though England, they didn't know that Salt would necessarily match Roy's output in terms of what he would average in the series, but they knew that he would play in the same way and try and score boundaries in the first over and try and maximise the power play. And I think at the end of the series, he was striking at something like 115, 120. I think he only scored 100 and something runs across the series. It wasn't like he had an amazing breakthrough, but he had a pretty solid series. And particularly in the last game when he hit four fours off and over from Shaheen Afridi, textbook sort of what Jason Roy would try and do in that situation. It would be try and hit four fours off the first over to set the tone and a chase of 332, I think.
I mean, that chase is interesting because I think you wrote in the book that it's only five times England had ever chased that. So even though they'd become a very good team, they hadn't done a lot of, 320-plus chases in that period. And yet they chase it with their third-string team, which is, I don't remember the Australia A team, for instance, doing anything that dramatic. Like that seems to me like a pretty big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're already 2-0 up in the series. And I think there was obviously an element of it being a dead rubber. But if you look through that game, they lost an early wicket as well. Milan was out in the second over. Salt and Crawley, I think, put on a pretty decent, a quick partnership. I think they were 80-2 or something like that off the power play. But then you had this really important partnership between Vince, who obviously scored, I think, what will probably be his only international 100 from number four, got 102 off 95. And then Lewis Gregory came in pretty low down. I think he was at number seven and hit 77. Both of those guys, you can see Vince, to some extent, was probably sodding in somewhere between a sort of Root and a Morgan type role. And Gregory probably doing something not dissimilar to what a Chris Wokes would have done in that situation. But it is a really incredible achievement, and I suppose shows probably the depth of talent that England have had in white ball cricket below the top level, because both of those guys are sort of similar age. They're in their early 30s now, and in previous eras would probably have played quite a lot of one day cricket for England because of the fact that England chopped and changed all the time. Mm. Whereas obviously one of the hallmarks of Morgan and Bayliss's team was giving that top six, you can rattle them off long runs, and the only real change was sort of the identity of the opening pair, which sort of flipped between Roy and Hales very briefly, Hales and Bairstow, and then Bairstow and Roy. But below those guys, there were a lot of very good players having very good county careers and playing a lot of franchise cricket as well. who didn't really get a look in another era might have played 40-odd ODIs, but in Gregory's case in particular, he's not going to end up with anywhere near that many, despite the fact he's a pretty handy player.
Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, PrizePicks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code PLAY100. That's code PLAY100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. PrizePicks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
Yeah, I think you're right. So one of the other things that Phil Salt, I think, told you guys was that they err on the positive side. That's easy to do when you are Liam Plunkett and you're coming back in and you're 30 and you're told, look, you might get hit for some fours and sixes, but we're going to give you a year and a half in this team. This is your new role and everything else. It's a little bit different when you're Lewis Gregory, for instance, and you're going to come in and this might be the only time you ever get to play for England. But it does feel, and we know that they've gone even more into this now with the baseball era. But even before that, they did get into a point where when they brought in replacements, they were saying, you are here for this reason. We back you and we want you to be positive. That's a message that is being pushed all the way through England white ball cricket and has been really for about 5-6 years now.
Yeah, and I think there's a story from, I think it's the first game of that series. Pakistan have bowled out for something like 140 odd in 30 something overs. So they really drag it out. There's not much they can do because they lose three or four early wickets, but they poke and prod around and just prolong everyone's misery. Basically, it's like a half empty stadium in Cardiff and it's a pretty grim watch. And the story goes, and this is not something I've stood up, which is one, you know, saying it on a podcast rather than
throwing it out there on a podcast.
Rather than doing it in print.
But it's just story, you and I here, no one else listening.
But the story goes that Stokes sort of told the team afterwards, you know, whatever we do in that series, make sure we don't at any point bat anything like that because no one wants to watch that. It was a waste of everyone's time. It would have been much more, you know, they would probably have had a much greater chance of winning that game if they risked the 10% chance of getting to 200 by having a swing rather than slowly bothering to get bowled out for 140, which is never going to be enough against, even a second and a half strong England team. So, yeah, it's something that's been ingrained in English cricket for a while is, the way that you get into that team is not necessarily it's not necessarily about runs, it's about style as well. You could be the leading scorer in the Blast for 3 years in a row, scoring at a strike rate of 120, and you wouldn't get picked for England's T20 team. Whereas if you had one brilliant season where you struck it 200 and averaged in the 30s, you would be absolutely straight in there or in the conversation at least. So so much of it's become about style. As you say, that's then now playing out in the test team as well.
What part do you think the franchise leagues have played? When T20 cricket first started, England players just weren't very popular, partly because their season was so long and it did overlap with other things. You know, there was issues with the IPL specifically, but right around the world, it was outside of the Perth Scorchers and maybe a little bit in the Big Bash, it didn't really feel like the rest of the world thought the England players were particularly good at white ball cricket. It took a long time for everyone to come in. It seems like that's been a very good second, or not. It basically, what the franchise leagues have gone on to do is what county cricket used to do for international cricket back in the day, which was allow for players to play for their pay, know that they might get dropped, but also learn things from other players and in other situations.
Yeah, I think it's massive. I think Salt is a very good example of it as well. I think he played 40-odd games in franchise leagues before making his England debut, which, you know, in the first instance shows that franchises were no longer just looking at England players or people whose name they recognised. It was this guy strikes really quickly in the blast and he's also a backup keeper. Why don't we try and get him in? And in his instance, you know, he was playing against Shaheen Afridi. He was, you know, facing his first ball in international cricket from Shaheen Afridi, but had played with and against him in the PSL. And I remember that one of the other things from the sort of intangible side of things is the crowds, because obviously Salt has played in front of 40, 50 odd, I don't know how big Adelaide Oval is, but he's played in the New Year's Eve game there before his international debut. He's played in the PSL in front of some big crowds when it's not been in COVID. He's played wherever else around the world. I think he's played a couple of games at the CPL by this point as well. I remember he told me that he sort of left his international debut, which was that game in Cardiff, England win convincingly by 9 wickets, I think. Basically thinking, is that it? Because this was sort of second year of COVID, partial crowds, a bit of a damp squib game in Cardiff where England, you know, milk it around in the run chase. And I remember he said that he got on the phone to one of his mates and said, I can't believe I've just played an international game that felt like county cricket, which, you know, compared to what it would have been like however many years ago when you would have had players suddenly playing in front of a crowd for the first time. When they make their debut, suddenly seeing themselves in the paper for the first time, suddenly getting interviewed for the first time. Salt's had all of that stuff by the time he's 24, 25, and when he makes his international debut, it's underwhelming, which is, yeah, a pretty extraordinary thing to have happened. But, yeah, I think demonstrates how franchisees have made players a lot readier than they were. And also England have a massive advantage in that now. And, you know, you talk about, especially early days, there being the old clash, particularly with the IPL. But if you think of the sort of number of leagues there are now and the number of leagues specifically that take place in the English winter, it's absolutely huge. So you had, I think, over 70 English players were, or England qualified players were playing in franchise leagues at the start of this year. And
it's basically, you know, November to March now, isn't it? Is kind of that mad T20 run where people like you and I are not actually sure which league we're watching.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of the time it seems like players aren't sure which day they're playing in. I think there was one week, I think it was in January or February, where Tomko Lacadmore, who fits into a similar sort of category to Salt, and that he's played a lot of league cricket already, but is probably, you know, in England's third or fourth choice white ball teams at the moment. I think he played in 3 different leagues in 7 days or something like that. And you have people jumping all around the place. So while that, you know, probably isn't great from a sort of global cricket point of view in terms of not knowing what you're watching and who you're playing for and promising the select Sixers fans that it's been your dream to kiss the badge. It's, from a talent ID point of view, to have the opportunities to play in, you know, 3 different Asian leagues in slightly different conditions generally and different teams and different roles is huge.
One other thing that England were very clear on, and it just goes back to the Phil Salt, we err on the positive side, is that they don't abuse attacking shots as long as they're a good option. And I know that when I first started working for teams, that's kind of what I did naturally, which was if someone went out, I would then go through what the field position was, what the bowler was, you know, what the matchup was. And if everything was in their favor and they still got caught at mid-on, I would say they did the right thing. They just didn't connect correctly. You know, if you want to have a look at the technical stuff, feel free to talk to them about the technical stuff. That is not how we've talked about cricket. My favorite story is, of course, Virender Sehwag, who always used to say, why does it matter if I'm caught a deep point or second slip? I'm still out court. And I don't think that's the way we've really ever thought about cricket and attacking. I'm not sure if that comes from Bayliss or from Morgan or who the basis of that is, but it makes a lot more sense than the old way of doing it, which is you're in a one-day team, of course you're going to play attacking shots. And it meant that it's probably why so many teams have held themselves back for so long.
Yeah, the best example we got from sort of researching for White Hot for this was Moeen talking about the 2015 World Cup. England played Sri Lanka and batted first. And at this point in Moeen's sort of weird and wonderful career, he was sort of almost like a pinch-hitting opener for a while for the Monday team. So it was him and Ian Bell opening for England. And I think they were 60 after 9 overs for none against Sri Lanka on a really flat pitch. But the sort of plan that had been set out by the management of where we should be at certain stages said that a good power play was 50 for none. And Murray basically explained it and said, well, you know, we were 16 for 9 off 9 and it felt like I hadn't really got going yet. So I sort of propped pretty early. It was a good pitch and I needed to take it on. And he plays a bit of a half-arse shot, but it is, you know, he sort of chips to mid-off in the 10th over, and he comes back and gets absolutely nailed by the management, basically saying, what were you doing? We'd already got 50. You didn't need to do that. And he said, you know, that kind of summed up what that team was like at the time. England managed to get, I think they got something like 320 in that game in the end, and ended up losing by 9 wickets with a few overs to spare. Sanger got a really good 100. And Mo said that, you know, as soon as Morgan sort of was able to take charge of the team himself rather than sort of inheriting a Cook Moores team, that completely changed. And they had the, you know, they obviously would do stuff like range hitting, pretty simple stuff that used to get criticized for, you know, if you're trying to hit sixes in practice and getting caught a deep in wicket, then you're practicing to get out, or something, you know, weird stuff along those lines that seems, you know, more outdated than 8 years ago. But yeah, England have sort of, I think as soon as that New Zealand series started in 2015, were, you know, we're not going to have anything to do with this. And Morgan himself was massive in that. I don't know if you remember the decider of that series against New Zealand, but Morgan was caught deep mid-wicket first ball in a run chase, which as England captain is sort of, you know, you think of England captains of the past and potentially doing that, they would have got absolutely nailed for it. But Morgan just sort of came back in, tracks his bat down and says, you know, it was the right option. I was facing
it was Santa. In my wheelhouse.
Exactly, yeah. I got a nice half volley on the pass from Santa. Why wouldn't I try and do it for 6? So, yeah, that I think that sort of sets the tone for it. And that's clearly been such a big tenet of England's white ball cricket since then is, you know, as long as you're out doing the right thing, or like taking on an option that would work for you most of the time, don't worry if it's attacking.
I remember covering the England-Scotland game in 2015, and I'm pretty sure that the first half of the game, England batted quicker than they did the second half of the game, and was it Preston Momsen or Carl Kutzer? I can't remember who went out when they were about 4 wickets down, but Scotland like could have easily chased that down if they just kept a couple more wickets, and it was just like, England could have made an extra 120 runs.
Yeah,
it was such a bizarre way of playing cricket, and they just kept doing it. It was so ridiculous. 2016, England decide that cricket is about power. So in 2018, I'm working with Brad Hodge, and we're in the nets, and Ruckin Cornwall and Odeon Smith and Andre Fletcher and you know, Karen Pollard and Darren Sammy are in there just smashing the ball out of the park. And Hodge turned to me at that stage and he said, I don't know how anyone is going to match these guys unless they start to think like them. And it's interesting because from that point forward, West Indies haven't had as much success. But basically what he was saying is that the raw power that they have, if they can, you know, continue to find batting talent who can connect with it, and they have, I suppose, in Puran and Hetmyer, but maybe not 5 or 6 guys like they had before. There was something else. But England were obviously thinking the exact same thing at the same time, perhaps inspired a little bit by Carlos Brathwaite, you know, completely smashing them around in the face in the World Cup. Because if you look at that World Cup, England were very free in the way they played, but they looked for force a lot. And after then, you can tell that they make a big decision to move towards sixes.
Yeah, I think, you know, people from the England setup have openly said, Butler said it himself, you know, inspired by that West Indies team. Absolutely. I think a lot of those guys have played with West Indies players in leagues around the world. That's where franchise cricket comes back into it. I mean, Butler tells the story about how, you know, how in run chases, people think about different things. So some people think about required rates and sort of trying to make sure the current rate is, you know, within touching distance of required. Some people look for, you know, the difference between runs and balls and stuff like that. And Butler said he basically now, and I think for the last probably 5-6 years now, tries to look at it in terms of counting a number of sixes that will that are still needed. And he learned that off, it's a really unlikely source. And I think it was Darren Bravo in the BPL when Josh Butler played a season of BPL.
Wow, Darren Bravo played one of the greatest T20 innings of all time against Lucia to lose me a game. So believe it or not, he had it in him.
There you go. And I bet he had a lot of sixes in that. But yeah, England are all over it in terms of power. And I think if you look at, if you sort of think of one of the players who has broken into the team the 15 to 19 team that sort of epitomizes that is probably Liam Livingstone, who obviously had this incredible breakthrough summer in 2021 where he goes from being a fringe player to suddenly, I think he hits a 40-odd ball T20-100 at Trent Bridge against Pakistan. He obviously has that incredible shot where he hits Harris Ralph over the rugby stand at Headingley. And his whole game really is based around power. And when he talks about batting, he almost speaks like a sort of bit like a golfer, like you hear him talk about my swing and stuff like that. And yeah, I think he sort of speaks about his desire to not just hit big sixes, but hit the biggest sixes. And I think he hit the biggest at both the T20 World Cup, the one in the UAE, and then also in the IPL the following year in 2022. And he's sort of, yeah, he's all about power. And yeah, England have obviously focused on that massively. And it's, yeah, a huge part of the whole culture that they try and create. And the whole idea of this England DNA is based around attacking cricket and power and, yeah, boundaries and sixes, and in a way that it hasn't ever been before. As you say, it's always been, particularly pre-2015, there isn't really an England DNA at all. And if there is one, it's, you know, test match players trying and failing to adapt to one day cricket on the hoof because they've been selected 2 weeks before a World Cup.
Well, I would say that my favourite moment of England white ball cricket was being at the MCG and watching Mark Elam come out as a pinch hitter. It was such a bizarre moment. And not that Mark Elam wasn't a good cricketer, but like he just didn't scream pinch hitter in any particular way. So things have changed a lot. You talk, because this chapter's about DNA, someone did put to me recently that the England white ball team is very old.
Yeah.
Right? So Stokes is obviously not going to play in the ODIs. Never been a huge force in T20 cricket in general, although he's had, you know, he was very good in that last final and he's had one great IPL season. You know, Root is quite old. Dawid Malan is quite old. Bairstow, Hales, right? Like we could go through them, right? Like Chris Jordan's still playing. You know, there's a lot of Adil Rashid, Moeen Ali, all these sorts of guys. How confident are you of the next generation? Because Harry Brook is the one that you talk about in this chapter where you say that he grew up watching the England players, right? And he's almost emboldened by the way that they've played, right? Mm. And I think that's a really important thing. But you can be as emboldened as anything. If you can't, you know, the West Indies had an incredible generation and then really haven't produced great batting talents after that, right? And so these things happen. That's just a natural thing that can happen. Because this chapter is partly about that Pakistan thing and everything else, how confident are you that you're seeing a long-term DNA the way that Australia did it? Because that Australia A team was young as hell and was... The Australia A team was far better than the England third 11. And I don't mean that as a disparaging comment. That was because they weren't picking their best one-day players at the time. And so they were all available for Australia A because they were picking their test team. But what I'm saying is you could look at that and you go, well, Ponting's 20 or 21, right? And, you know, all these players are mid-20s. There's incredible talent there. Whereas you look at the England team and you're like, there's still a lot of 28 to 32-year-olds coming through. As you said, the Lewis Gregory type players, they're not going to... They might be handy in a World Cup, right? You know, in that David Willey style, but they're probably not your front line. Do you think the main six or seven players that they're going to need are going to be strong enough in the next generation, knowing what you know about the young England players coming through?
My hunch is that they will be good enough in terms of, I don't know whether they'll necessarily win England's consecutive World Cups or two out of three World Cups that it's been, but I think they will consistently compete. And I think... Yep. The key thing when we sort of tried to talk about this chapter is even if you go to a point where England have a slightly fallow period, they will never or should never at least revert to the point of doing all the stupid stuff that they did before 2015 in white ball cricket and one day cricket, because they have a clear identity. You know how an England team's going to play. And even if this generation of players, there's a lot of players, we talk about this in the book, there's a lot of players in English cricket generally, but specifically white ball cricket, who were born between 1989 and 91. So that's all the guys you mentioned there. So, you know, Root, Stokes. Butler.
Let's just call them the Pro 40 generation, because you know that's all I'm thinking about.
Um, So the Pro 40 generation, the Clydesdale Bank generation. So all of those guys are around the same age. And as you say, there's obviously going to have to be a refresh. But I think that the challenge for England, as I see it, will be finding the right point to sort of start introducing those guys more regularly, just as much as anything, because of the fact there's an ICC event every single year. So I think there will be a natural refresh after the 2024 T20 World Cup, because I think they'll look at the Champions Trophy in 25 and think that's the least important upcoming ICC event. And that's a good opportunity to refresh. But I think if you look at a batting lineup of England players under a certain age, you know, you could have Salt and Jacks opening. Brooke, I think, is a long-term solution as well. You have a sort of, I think with county cricket as well, and just the number of players involved in it, there's always going to be someone coming through. So like James Roux at the moment is the guy that a lot of people are getting very excited about, mainly as a sort of four-day batter at the moment, but he's scoring 50 over hundreds as well in the Metro Bank Cup. Personally, I think that the key thing from the England white ball point of view is that they will no longer go back to doing that dumb stuff, and that they will have an identity at least. And yeah, even if they miss out on a semi-final once or twice, there will be a next generation coming through and they will be playing roughly in the same way. They're not going to go back to being a team that tries to get 270 and defends it. They're always going to be a team that aims high and sometimes misses it and accept that that's fine.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think that's what the chapter's really about, isn't it? It's about the fact that they've changed their DNA. It won't always work because you can't really, you know, there is no Joe Root replacement or even an Owen Morgan replacement as the team currently stands, right? There's not an Adil Rashid replacement. It's probably not a genuine Moeen Ali replacement. Like, there's some players that are, you know, just going to be tough. Whereas there are other guys where you just like, they can probably find maybe another Plunkett and they can, you know, probably find another Chris Jordan and those sorts of guys. So, no, it's very interesting. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are many other extras as well, including a Discord channel. There's a link to those in the show notes. Please review, subscribe, and tell all your friends about our show. Word of mouth is the best way of making our podcast grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bharat Sundaresan and Bayram Kazi. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston. Each episode is produced by Ishit Kuberka at Sound Potion Studio. The team from 42 help us out with the video side. Orajoti Senapayi and Maida Akam, both producing podcasts, while Mukunda Bandredi is the head of our YouTube content.